Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Rabbi Alex Israel discusses Parshat Truma. Rabbi Alex Israel is a faculty member at Pardes and serves as the Pardes Director of Continuing Education. And now, Rabbi Alex Israel.
Thank you, Larry. This week we're going to discuss Parshat Truma, which is a tremendously colorful parsha. This week's Parshat Shavua, we see the construction of the Mishkan, the Tabernacle, with its finery and its incredible architectural detail, going into the cubits and into the very fabrics which from which are constructed the sanctuary, the Mishkan, the portable temple, which the Israelites carry through the Midbar. We talk about gold, silver, copper, Tchelet, blue thread, Argaman, the crimson thread, Tolat Shani, purple is Argaman, sorry, Tolat Shani is red, V'sheish, V'izim, V'rotelim, different skins, or different goat hair, ram skins, acacia wood, the various stones that are used. A very colorful and visual parsha greets us here. It is true that when we read the depictions here in the Torah text, sometimes they can get a little technical. Occasionally we read them and it looks sort of like a set of architectural plans. And after a while we are sort of dazzled by the dimensions here. And it would really be worthwhile for anybody who wants to understand the parasha to get hold of a useful visual aid. There are books dedicated to the construction of the Mishkan, which describe very ably, by use of pictures, the way that everything looked. I think even in the back of the art scroll Chumash, there is a very, very useful picture, because otherwise sometimes it's difficult to visualize exactly how everything is constructed. Through all this detail, let's deal with some of the basic issues at the heart of the parsha. And I think the big question that we want to attack is why we need a Mishkan at all. Why does God need a temple? Already, King Solomon, when he dedicates the temple in Jerusalem in his inaugural speech, he starts off with, I think, what is the obvious instinct of all of us modern people when we come to think about the notion of a house for God, where he turns to God and he says, O Lord God of Israel, in the heavens above and the earth below, there is no God like you. And he says, can God really dwell on earth? Even the heavens, to their uttermost reaches, cannot contain you, how much less this house that I have built. This is a direct challenge to the pasuk, the verse which we see in our parsha, Va'asu li mikdash v'shachanti b'tocham. Make me a sanctuary that I may dwell amongst them. It is true that God never says that he will dwell in the sanctuary, in the Mishkan. And yet the assumption is that in some way we are making a house for God. What does it mean to make a house for God? Does God really need a house? What is this? So I think that in order to describe this, in order to explain what we're talking about, I think we need to use our brains a little bit and our hearts a little bit. Firstly, before we get to the commentators, I think we all have to realize that to function in life through institutions, there are places which make us feel certain things. There are moments and events which we use, certain formulae, which we use in order to instigate various feelings. And these rituals really become part of our life. Every single culture has a marriage ritual, has a marriage ceremony. And without that, we don't really feel married. We have a graduation ceremony. And this is filtered down from universities to high schools to elementary schools, because without a graduation ceremony, have we really finished? I have an aunt who was totally detached from any organized religion. She was Jewish by birth, but didn't really identify very much with her Judaism. But I recall that she used to have a Christmas ritual, which involved certain foods, and particularly watching The Wizard of Oz and other things. She needed to create rituals in her life. We need rituals in order to, as human beings, we regulate our life with certain rituals, which create special moments, which commemorate sad moments, which allow us to get through moments of transition. And every person has certain rituals which shape their life. Likewise, we have certain institutions, institutions which are hallowed, institutions which allow us to undergo certain change or certain moments, whether it is even the, again, if I can talk in a secular sense, whether it is the hallowed silence of the library, or even the bustle of the mall, all sorts of different things in our life, we would hear those sounds, we would go in that environment, and they immediately give us an instinctual way to act. This, indeed, is the approach of the Sefer HaChinuch. When the Sefer HaChinuch talks about the Mishkan, the Sefer HaChinuch says that, really, it's not that God needs a house. God doesn't need a house, it's for human beings. Human beings need a place which represents God. We need a place in order to direct our prayers. And therefore, God prescribed a particular location. He gave the people, and because this place represents God, it has to be full of sense of majesty, of dignity. The people who work in that environment are enclosed in ways which befits the regal nature of God's house, a house which is dedicated to God. But moreover, for the Kohen himself, for the priest himself, the priest has clothing which helps focus his mind on the correct themes. The people who go there have an environment which is absolutely dedicated and focused on the Almighty, on matters of the Spirit, removed from the world, and enables a person to remove themselves from the humdrum, hubbub, and noise of daily existence to focus on something higher. The Sefer HaChinuch goes even further with other things. For example, the music of the temple and the smell of the incense, and he talks about the need for a human being to be elevated through his aesthetic sense, and therefore all of the beautiful fabrics, but moreover even the smells and the music are there to elevate a person, to take us onto a higher plane so that we can focus our mind on God. For the Sefer HaChinuch, he's a 13th century Spanish commentator, we're not quite sure who the author was, but he wrote a book describing many different mitzvot, parsha by parsha, all the 613 commands. The Sefer HaChinuch says that the temple is really there, if you want, not as a house of God. The sanctuary is not there in some way to contain the divine presence, but rather it is there for human beings. It's there to allow human beings a sacred space. It's there to allow human beings the ritual that they need in order to connect with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with God himself, who is obviously above and beyond anything in the temple. This is, I think, a very reasonable and rational approach that we can appreciate. But what is it precisely about the Mishkan which enables us to do that? Which, if you want, are the central kelim, the central vessels, the central items in the Mishkan which allow us to somehow connect with God? What I would like to do is go maybe a stage deeper, deeper than the Sefer HaChinuch, and use the commentary of Nachmanides. And Nachmanides has, I think, a very, very deep idea, relying on textual parallels, which explains something about the temple. Nachmanides, being a mystic, is, and also, I think, from his approach to Parshanut, to biblical commentary, actually wants to claim that God's presence is manifest in the temple. It is not just a place where we go to somehow seek God, but God's presence is, in a sense, manifest in the temple. His starting point is fascinating. His starting point is to compare Mount Sinai, at the moment when the Torah is given, when God reveals his presence on the mountain, to compare Mount Sinai with the temple itself. What do I mean? Well, on Mount Sinai, if you recall, the people were cordoned off and they weren't allowed to ascend the mountain because the mountain was holy. And certain people, the Kohanim and the 70 elders, were allowed to go a little further. They were the functionaries. And Moses was allowed to go even higher, to the top of the mountain. What represented this incredible holiness of the mountain, which restricted people's entrance? It was God's presence itself. God's presence, which was represented in thunder and lightning, which was represented in fire at the top of the mountain. And of course, what was God doing? He was giving the Torah. So if you can take this image of a Mount Sinai with the Torah, so to speak, at the top, surrounded by fire, and the restricted levels of entry, the Ramban, Nachmanides, wants to transpose this into the sanctuary itself. You see, in the sanctuary, there were three different zones. On the outside, courtyard, all Jews who were holy, who had purified themselves, could come. That's like the foot of the mountain, where when they approached Mount Sinai to to actually see God. The Jews were told, the Israelites were told in Shemot chapter 19, they were told that for 3 days they had to purify themselves. They had to wash themselves. As the Lord said to Moses, chapter 19, verse 10, go to the people and warn them to stay pure today and tomorrow. Let them wash their clothes. One of the things that a Jew had to do before they came to the temple was to go to the mikveh, to go to the ritual bath and purify themselves. And anyone who visits the southern wall excavations by the temple site today in Jerusalem sees all the archaeological remains of different mikvahot, different ritual baths there, as which people would immerse in before they went into the temple. So the outer courtyard is accessible to all Israel as they come and approach God. They have to purify themselves just like the Israelites did at the foot of Mount Sinai. However, the priests, the Kohanim, are allowed to go further in. They're allowed to go further inside, just like the priests and 70 elders were allowed to ascend Mount Sinai. However, there is only one person who is allowed to go into the Holy of Holies, almost like a parallel of Moses, who was allowed to ascend to the pinnacle, to the peak of Mount Sinai. And that is Aaron, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. Three different zones, three different levels. As we approach God, only certain people are given access, one person, in fact, either Moses, in the case of Mount Sinai, or Aaron, in the case of the Mishkan. The functionaries or officiaries, they're allowed to go into the medium zone, and the people stay at the perimeter. However, what is at the focus of the Mishkan? That is the item or the piece of furniture, the artifact, the functional object, which is at the center of the Mishkan, or the innermost point in the Holy of Holies, is actually the Ark of the Covenant. For those of you who are not sure what I'm referring to, just remember that old Indiana Jones movie, and you'll know what I'm talking about. The Ark of the Covenant, that golden piece of furniture. Now, what is this? What is this box? It's essentially a box with cherubs on the top, angelic-like figures on the top. But what's inside? Our Parashat Shavua tells us exactly what's inside. We will read it. It's in chapter 25, and it tells us what you're meant to do. It says, you shall make an ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits long, 1.5 cubits wide, 1.5 cubits high, overlay it with pure gold. It has to have poles. But it says, and deposit in the ark the tablets of the pact which I will give you. The tablets of the covenant. The two luchot, the two tablets of stone which were given on Mount Sinai, are actually placed and deposited inside the box, and then the top is put on. As I mentioned, it has keruvim, angelic cherubs on the top. But something else we're told in verse 22, chapter 25, verse 22, something else we're told about the ark. It says, God tells Moses, there I will meet with you. I will impart to you from above the cover, from between the two cherubs that are on top of the ark of the covenant, all that I will command you concerning the Israelite people. The epicenter of the temple, the epicenter of the Mishkan, is the ark of the covenant. It is the ark of the covenant because it contains the covenant. It contains the tablets of stone. And what happens by this ark? What happens by this ark is this is the place where God speaks to Moses with his messages to the people. Maybe now we can actually understand the parallel between the ark itself and the top of Mount Sinai. Because the top of Mount Sinai is a place of God's intense presence where God transmits Torah, teaching, to Bnei Israel. Likewise, it would appear that the central function of the Aron, of the ark, in the Mishkan, in the tabernacle, is in order to command the people. Again, I'll read the verse. There I will meet you, and I will impart to you from above the cover, from between the two cherubs that are on top of the Ark of the Covenant. There I will command you concerning the Israelite people. It is the place of communication. This is a hallowed zone, the Holy of Holies, and only it's like the top of the mountain. It is there in order to give Torah. It represents Torah. The cherubs maybe represent the presence of God, which would be hovering above them in some way. And inside the box is the Torah, which is the covenant itself, the conditions, the terms of our covenant with God. Let me read to you the words of the Rambam. After all this introduction, let me read to you the words of Nachmanides, where he's going to explain the reason for this parallel. And he says the following. God had spoken with Israel face to face, directly, delivering to them the Ten Commandments. And Israel had accepted the performance of these commands that he would issue via Moses. A covenant had been cut on this very act. Now, the Israelites are his nation, and he is to them as a God, as he had defined from the start. It is befitting, then, that a hope for a holy nation, that there be within their midst a sanctuary, so that God's presence may dwell amongst them. Hence, he commanded as the very first command that there be a Mishkan, a house sacred to his name, where he could speak with Moses and command the children of Israel. The central focus of the Mishkan, the place of God's presence, is the Aron, is the Ark of the Covenant. As it states, there I will meet you, etc., etc. And what he parallels here is also another fascinating thing. When the Mishkan is inaugurated, and this is, if you look, you'll find it in Shemot, in Exodus chapter 40, right at the end of the book. When the Mishkan is inaugurated, it is filled with cloud, the cloud of God, so much so that Moshe cannot even enter the cloud. And if you look, this is a direct parallel to the image at Mount Sinai. If you can, again, you can check it in Shemot chapter 24, where it says that God's presence rested on Mount Sinai, and a cloud covered it for 6 days, and God called to Moses on the seventh day from the cloud. Apparently Moses couldn't enter the cloud for 6 days. He was restricted because the presence of God was so intense on the mountain. Likewise, Moses was restricted at the start from entering into the temple because God's presence was there. The Ramban even goes so far to say that the golden color of the Aron, of the Ark, is meant to in some way parallel the fire of Sinai. Let me try and summarize what I think the Ramban is trying to say. The Ramban is making a very, very deep point. If we have made a covenant with God, we want some contact with God. It is a living relationship. It is not something remote. We need a tangible evidence of that interrelationship. Of course, relationship is very deep. And the relationship which is going to take place here is actually speech. Panim el panim, face to face, where Moses can talk to God face to face. Mount Sinai was not meant to be a historic once in a lifetime or once in a history event. It was not meant to be an event that we left in the past. The idea of the Mishkan, the idea of the sanctuary, was that we should be able to take Mount Sinai with us. That we should have a portable Mount Sinai that we would be able to take from place to place. Hence, just let me maybe add one further point, sorry. The point of Mount Sinai was the giving of the Torah, but it was much more than that. It was the fact that the Jewish people had the opportunity to experience God, to experience the living God talking to them, interacting with them, commanding them. This revelation, this experiential involvement with God was crucial, was critical. And it is apparent that God wanted this to continue. Now, of course, this is dangerous stuff. Proximity to God can be very, very dangerous. And so what God did was, in order to continue this, created a mini Mount Sinai, a Mount Sinai in miniature. But in order to continue the Sinai experience, he encapsulated his presence into the Mishkan itself, where the magnet for God's Shekhinah in some way is sometimes described as God's footstool, is the Aron, is the Ark of the Covenant. It contains the conditions of the law, the tablets itself, and that is a place where nobody is allowed to go except the very, very special representative of the people, Moses himself, and only then for the purpose of communicating with God for the people. There are functionaries around who provide a buffer zone, and the Jewish people are allowed to be at the perimeter, knowing that God's presence is some way tangibly in their midst. Now, if this sounds a little strange, I'd actually like to refer to a children's book. And this is a children's book by Joel Grishover. Some of you might have seen his educational children's literature, or some of it's even for adults. But some years ago, when I was trying to think of what to talk to my children about at the Shabbat table on Parashat Truma, and I was looking for some inspiration, I opened Joel Grishover's book on Parashat Shavuah. It's a children's book. It's called A Garden of Torah or something like that. And he relates very interestingly to the connection between a few words. The word Shechina, which we talk about, and the word Mishkan. Today, in modern Hebrew, Mishkan actually means a residence. It simply means a residence. We talk about Mishkan HaNasi, the residence of the president here in Israel. It's called Mishkan. But I'm not sure I'd associated that those words together. Let me read the words of Joel Grishover, and you'll hear what I have to say. God made plans for a place where God would always be a neighbor. It was called the Mishkan. It could be moved from place to place. Mishkan comes from a word that means neighborhood. No matter where Israel moved, God was their neighbor. What's amazing about this very simple description, which is written for children, is that it suddenly made me think about the notion of Mishkan, Shachen, which means neighbor, Shchuna, which means neighborhood, and Shechina, which means God's presence. Sometimes when somebody talks about the Shechina, God's presence, we imagine some very hallowed, cloud-like presence. However, really Shechina is simply a conjugation of the word Shchuna, neighborhood. When God says in the opening lines of our Parashat Shavuah, Va'asuli mikdash, make me a sanctuary. Va'shachanti betocham, I will dwell amongst them. What we're really saying is something quite incredible. We're saying that God is moving into the neighborhood. God is becoming our neighbor. Now, by the way, if God is our neighbor, you know, this means certain obligations to us. If we had somebody move in who was a celebrity in our street, that would sort of raise the neighborhood. This raises the whole Israelite camp. There is an aim for God not to be up there, in the clouds, beyond, transcendent. God wants to be imminent. God wants to be with us. God wants to be together with the Jewish people. He made a covenant with us. He told us he would be our God and we would be his holy nation. But what he means is he wants some sort of association with us. Here you understand that we're going in a very, very different direction from the Sefer HaChinuch. The Sefer HaChinuch didn't deal with the fact that God's presence was actually in this house. He simply spoke about the fact that this was a place where we could cleanse our minds and we could direct our hearts towards God. The Mishkan is really, in a sense, according to the Sefer HaChinuch, for man. However, for the Ramban, God's presence is really there. For the Ramban, this is really a place where God's presence, and I'm not sure what even this means, is manifest in a special way. Maybe if we don't really understand it, I'd say it differently. This is a place where we can really communicate with God. So I think the Ramban's idea of this being a perpetual Mount Sinai, a miniature Mount Sinai, a place in which God so much desires to have a connection with Israel that he wants to follow us around, that we carry him with us, that he always wants to have this relationship with us, this hub whereby we can connect with him. I think that's a phenomenally powerful idea. Maybe we also understand the notion that if we sin, God's presence leaves the temple, or maybe even the temple is destroyed, because when we break the relationship, well, of course, if we betray the relationship, well, then there is no relationship. Then our partner is not there. Then there, once the presence, the divine presence in the temple is gone, well, there's no real point in the building, is there? However, I'd like to go into a third idea to finish off this shiur, which again is a very interesting idea. We've spoken about Nachmanides, the Ramban, but I'd like to turn my attention to Maimonides. Maimonides is unique because in Maimonides' Book of Law, the Mishneh Torah, Maimonides, unlike the Shulchan Aruch, the Book of Law, which we usually use to paskin halakha, to decide what our everyday ritual should be, the Shulchan Aruch is a book of halakha for non-temple times, for exile. It's a book which doesn't deal with any temple laws or even doesn't mention many of the laws of Israel. It doesn't talk about Shemitah, the seventh year. It doesn't talk about many laws which have fallen into which have lapsed because the Jews have left their land and stopped being a nation anymore. However, Maimonides wrote a book of law, his Mishneh Torah. He wrote a book for all time. Maimonides wrote a book which included all the laws of sacrifices, included the laws of how a king should function, including laws of a Sanhedrin, how the Supreme Court should function in Jerusalem. And he also included, as I said, the laws of his temple. And when Maimonides codifies the law of the temple, it's very interesting what he considers to be the central function of the temple. He says there, and it's in Hilchot Beit HaBechira, chapter 1, the laws of the temple, the first chapter, Mitzvah Asei La'asot Bayit Lashem, it is a positive command, it is an instruction to make a house for God, where Liot Makrivim Bo Korbanot, where we should bring sacrifices. He then continues and talks about all the details, and one of the most important things that he mentions is the altar where we bring those sacrifices. But one of the things that he does not mention until the very end is the Ark of the Covenant, the Aron. For Maimonides, it is fascinating that the Aron is actually a secondary item. When Maimonides talks about it, when the Rambam talks about it, he actually says that, hold on a second, he says, in the Second Temple, there wasn't even an Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant had disappeared. According to tradition, it had been hidden. When they knew that the enemy were advancing, it had been hidden. Certainly, it went missing. And there was no Ark of the Covenant in the Second Temple. Says the Rambam, says Maimonides, therefore we see that you can have a temple without the Ark of the Covenant. Now, hold on a second. According to the Ramban, according to Nachmanides, the center, the epicenter of the whole temple is the Aron. How can you have a temple without an Aron? How can you have a temple without the Ark of the Covenant? It's all about that connection. So Maimonides says, no, actually, you don't understand what the temple is about. The temple is actually about the Mishkan, the sanctuary, the Beit HaMikdash, is actually a place where we approach God. And he talks about the main purpose as sacrifices. If I can use their Hebrew term, korbanot. Korbanot are about kirva. They are about coming near to God. Lit karev. Korban from the root kufresh bet, karov, near. You bring a korban so that you can approach God. It means it's about approaching. Here we have two different conceptions of what the temple is all about. For the Ramban, it's all about God's presence. For Nachmanides, it's all about God's presence. Focused where? Focused at the Ark of the Covenant, at the epicenter of the temple. However, for Maimonides, for the Rambam, it is not about the Ark of the Covenant. It's not about God approaching us. It is actually about us approaching God. It is about us stepping forward to God. It's about us sending that altar and offering something to God, offering our korbanot, our sacrifices. What I find fascinating about the dichotomy between these two approaches is actually they choose completely different items, completely different kilim, functional objects of the Mishkan in order to focus their attention. For the Rambam, for Maimonides, it is the altar. For Nachmanides, it is the ark itself. For Nachmanides, the aim is for God to come down to man. For Maimonides, the aim is for man to go up to God. However, according to both opinions, the aim is that somehow the Mishkan is a place where we meet God, where we have contact, relationship. If God is saying that this is a Mishkan, a place of his presence, if God is going to be our Shachain, he is going to move into the neighborhood, if we are going to have Shekhinah, which means that God is moving into the Shechuna, into the neighborhood, then we have to be able to approach him. For Nachmanides, God comes down to earth. He comes to meet us. For Maimonides, we have to ascend to God. We have to approach God with our gifts. We have to approach God with our state of mind, which must be pure when bringing a korban, when bringing a sacrifice. But whichever way, the Mishkan is meant to afford us an opportunity for us to meet God. So behind all of the fabrics, and behind all of the architectural plans, behind all the dimensions that we read in the lines of this week's Parashat Shavua, we shouldn't let all of that obscure the ultimate aim of the tabernacle. The tabernacle, it's a funny word, the tabernacle is really a Mishkan, a home, a residence. It's really a residence. It's meant to be, maybe put it a different way, an opportunity for meeting God, an opportunity for us to get into contact with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and to be able to really feel that we have access to God and that God wants to be alongside his people. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Israel. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated, so send your emails to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.